supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Are you feeling lonely? If so, you're not alone. Seems like more and more people complain of loneliness, and with the holidays around us, even more so. But what is this phenomenon of loneliness? Is it a fact of being alone, or is it an emotion? My guest today, John Cacioppo, says that the effects of prolonged loneliness, regardless of the definition, can be very damaging, even lethal. So what can be done about it? How can we change it? Or should we simply learn to live with it better? We want to hear your story. If you're feeling lonely today, especially, maybe you've experienced a divorce or lost a loved one, or it's something you've carried much of your life, give us a call. 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. And like I said, we're joined right now on the telephone by John Cacioppo, who's a professor of psychology at the University of Chicago. And his most recent book is called Loneliness, Human Nature, and the Need for Social Connection. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, let's begin with what I said in the billboard. A generally accepted definition is that loneliness isn't whether we live alone, it's whether we feel alone, yes?
Yes, correct. Feeling alone is something that one can experience even when in the presence of others. The holiday season is one of those times when people can feel very isolated even though there's family and friends around.
So let's try to understand what happens to our bodies when we're feeling lonely. It's interesting. In your book, you compared it to diabetes, which disrupts our ability to regulate sugar. Does something get dysregulated when we're lonely?
Yes, indeed. We've studied everything from the activity of the brain through brain imaging techniques to gene expression, and found loneliness affects the brain's activity, the biology, hormonal activity, cardiovascular activity, and even gene expression inside the nucleus of cells.
So what does it do? What are the implications of that dysfunction?
One of the things that loneliness is associated with is increased vascular resistance. This is the resistance of blood flow throughout the body. And over years, we have found loneliness predicts increases in blood pressure in individuals. So these are two very deleterious consequences of maintaining a feeling of isolation from others over a long period of time.
You've compared it to thirst and hunger, but we can't live without food and water, yet many people do well living alone. But you're suggesting that we couldn't survive if we lived with sustained feelings of loneliness, yes?
Correct. The reason we relate it to hunger and thirst, those are both aversive cues that signal us we need to do something to survive and prosper. In the case of dehydration, you need to hydrate. You need to take in liquids. Hunger, of course, you need to take in nutrients. If you ignore those signals, then you do so at risk of damage to the body. Loneliness has been conceived as depression or personality deficit, and those our research did not bear out. In fact, we find quite the opposite, that loneliness is just like hunger and thirst as an aversive cue that signals the need to connect with others. We are fundamentally social creatures, and if we don't have those connections, whether we're alone or with others, if we don't feel connected to others, then we do so at our own peril.
Well, wait a minute. You said if we don't have those connections, And then you said if we don't feel connected to others. So what is that some people need to feel more connected to others than other people? For example, I'm a clinician, and, you know, I treat both genders and I treat cultures, couples, and by and large, men have fewer friends than women, of course, but men report loneliness less than women.
That's actually a very interesting observation. When you don't use the word loneliness, men and women are equally likely to feel lonely. If you ask, do you feel lonely, men underreport. So the people don't want to admit being lonely, especially men, because it's seen as a sign of personal weakness. That's not actually the case. In our own research, we use surveys that do not use the word loneliness. You also mentioned that friendships or being alone are not the same thing, and you're absolutely correct. When we've looked at loneliness, we have found it's not the presence of others that's critical. It's really the quality of those relationships. When we've looked at marital status, for instance, married individuals tend, on average, to be less lonely than non-married individuals. But as you well recognize, there can be true feelings of isolation in the midst of a marriage.
I have to ask you, John, I want to go to the phones. We've got people who want to join the conversation. But before we do, what did you ask in those surveys? You said men tend to underreport when you use the label loneliness.
Yes.
So what kind of questions do you ask?
Are there others with whom you can confide? Are there others around who understand you? Questions of that type. And that's from a survey developed at UCLA about 30 years ago, where they took the beliefs of people who were highly lonely and those who weren't at all lonely, and they looked at how those beliefs and experiences differed between the two, and the scale was actually developed based on those kinds of questions.
Interesting. So let's go to the phones. We've got David on the line. David, hi. You're on Voices.
Hi, Doctor. I've emailed you several times offering suggestions on your show, and you've always graciously responded to me. I'm very happy to have this opportunity to give my view on this.
Great.
I am 59, gay, and I have not one friend in the world. However, I am never lonely. What I do is I read nonfiction, and I am decent to everyone. I try to be decent to everyone. And honestly, I love to be with people, but only for like a work day or something like that. In the evening, I just want to be alone, reading and thinking and pondering. I don't want the types of shallow friendships most people have. And honestly, and this may go counter to everything, I really and truly can honestly say I don't feel lonely.
Do you feel at peace?
Extremely.
So
I mean, economically, I'm not doing so well, but as far as
that's a whole different show.
Yeah, I know it is. It really is. And as far as, you know, going into a room full of people, I enjoy talking with them, learning from them, learning advice. But, you know, when the party's over, I don't want people. And it's not that I don't like them. I just need my solitude.
David, you know, you're talking to two psychologists here, and I don't think...
That's why I wanted to call in, because
listen,
I want to hear what you say.
Yeah, I don't think either one of us are going to be shocked. John, are you?
No.
Okay, you aren't. That's interesting.
No, so tell us why. Because a lot of our listeners are surprised that you're not shocked.
Yeah, you know, I guess I'm tired of hearing that anybody who doesn't have friends... Like, I don't believe in Barbra Streisand's song, people who need people are the luckiest people. I mean, I don't have any problem with people who need people, but I really think there are people out there who really don't need that.
John?
Yes. In fact, what you've described is important to recognize, and one of the reasons why being alone is not the same thing as feeling lonely. You've done a couple of things that we find to be very powerful ways of dealing with feelings of isolation, and that is enjoying other activities. Reading is a terrific one because you can think into a story that's compelling to you and really get yourself situated in a space that's very rewarding without having others around. The second thing I would say, though, is we have done studies of heritability, and found there's genetic component to loneliness. Loneliness is about 50% heritable. Some individuals, and you sound like one of these individuals, just doesn't have a strong need for others. And so that need is satisfied much more quickly, much more easily than for other individuals. And there's nothing wrong with being high or low in that particular need. It's just genetic variation that makes us who we are.
Yeah, and I, as a clinician, John, I have come to see over the years that everybody is on a continuum on every different dimension
right.
of personality and life. And, you know, so David's not in the middle of that continuum. So what? You know,
right.
And too many people just, you know, we want to categorize. I think pop psychology has done a great deal of harm in that regard.
I agree.
You know, that we try to analyze people. David, enjoy your books. Enjoy your nonfiction books.
Yeah,
I hope John's book is one of them. I hope my books are some of them. So enjoy. And I'll see you via email. So that's what we have to look at, is how people really, really are on a continuum. Much of your work, John, is from an evolutionary perspective. So
yes.
Tell us about the function of our evolved brains and really the purpose of these big frontal lobes that we have that distinguish us from other mammals.
Yes, in fact, one of the interesting things, neuroscientists like myself have tended to think of the brain as having evolved and then the social aspects to have come along later. And in fact, more recent research suggests just the opposite, that we have big frontal lobes and highly convoluted brains because of the need for processing capacities as a social animal. The complexities of the world are not nearly as difficult to deal with if you ignore the social domain. We're very complicated social creatures. I have to be able to read your mind and community in order to communicate and work effectively with you. But that turns out to be the power of us as a species. We're not particularly formidable. We don't have natural armor or flight or weapons at our fingertips. Instead, we communicate and work together. So that's fundamentally how we survive and prosper as social creatures.
Dan Gilbert, who wrote Stumbling on Happiness, has said that he's a cognitive psychologist at Harvard, and he says that our frontal lobes are what allows us to project into the future, so that
right.
a lot of our behavior is about taking care of our future selves, our image of the self that will be in the future, making the future self happier or safer or less at risk. But I think doing that could make us more social. It could also make us more isolated and even suspicious of other, too, in the process.
Well, in fact, the frontal lobes are responsible for a wide variety of functions, including executive control, that is, the ability to exert willpower, and our social behavior. Frontal temporal dementia, a dementia of the frontal lobes, is associated with no loss in cognitive prowess, but it is associated with the loss of empathy and ability to really communicate effectively and relate to other people. So the frontal lobes are the most recently evolved aspects of the cortex and play a very important role in social functioning.
You know, we're talking about this, the importance of social connection and social function, but I have to tell you, most of my great learning in life, and I don't think I'm alone here, most of my great learning has been a byproduct of solitude, of really experiencing myself as exquisitely alone and experiencing that moment, not as a temporary moment, but as a fundamental truth.
Well, I think I would take issue with you on one point. If you think about everything that we know, almost all of it has come from some kind of social source. The books that we read, the teaching that we went through when we were kids, from our parents, from observing others. Now, that's not to say that consolidate that. To think about all its implications is not best performed when in solitude. I mean, it's a complex world. So to really see all the ramifications of our experiences, of what we've read, having few distractions aids us in that consideration. And that's where solitude can be very important. But if you think about what information we get and how powerful that information is, it's primarily from social sources.
Interesting. Let's let's see if we can get another call on before our break. We'll go to Lauren. Lauren, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I come from a big family, and I've always experienced loneliness in that family and that I don't feel like part of them. So when the holidays come, I get very anxious because I know I'm going to be seeing my family, and yet even as they're here, and it's a huge group, and they're all around, I feel incredibly lonely in that situation. So I tend to isolate when it's not holiday time, and then I feel lonely. And although I need a lot of alone time, I'm still feeling disconnected.
I'm a little confused, Lauren, about what the issue is. Is the issue loneliness for you that causes you to suffer? Or are you suffering because of your anxiety about loneliness?
Oh, well, there you go. I don't know that I do have anxiety, but I think that the loneliness, I can remember, you know, back being a small child, being very lonely.
So that if I could cure your anxiety about feeling lonely, you would still suffer?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I got to hand it over to the expert now.
Yes, actually, your experience sounds familiar. This time of year is very difficult for people, in part because our loneliness derives from a number of sources, but one of the sources comes from comparing ourselves to other people. And the holiday season is associated with family and friends getting together and you know, feeling joyous about it. And so if that's our comparison, if we think that's the norm, and we find ourselves feeling isolated in that circumstance, the pain of that isolation is exaggerated because it violates what we see everybody else experiencing. Now, in fact, you're not alone. Many people experience what you're describing, but we don't think that. We think the normal person is feeling all the joyous celebration of being together that is advertised. So one thing to realize is that your experience isn't as rare as it might seem to be. The second is family in particular are complex, as you know, and people have different experiences with family. One of the things Laura Carstensen, a psychologist out at Stanford University, has found is that as people age, they start to narrow the number of contacts and friends they have. And they do this because they start to associate only with those individuals with whom they have high-quality relationships. And one of the more interesting and surprising findings from our research is that family members are the ones who often get trimmed from the list of people who they continue to associate with just because of the complexities that you described. So your experience is not as unique as you may think that it is. So, and I hope that's consoling to you.
So, Lauren, one of the things I'm hearing John say is that part of your suffering is about your expectations, that you think you should feel a certain way or that your family should be a certain way. And, you know, these are simple facts that you are different maybe from your family in so many respects, or your family is weird, or whatever the facts are that are in your head, it's the shoulds that cause the suffering. Am I getting... Yes?
Well, I think you could be right there, but I'm also worried that I'm choosing to feel lonely. I'm choosing to isolate from them, and it's not benefiting me to make that choice, but I don't feel a connection with them, and...
You're doing it again. See how you're judging yourself. There's more should. There's more shoulds inside yourself. It's exactly what John said. It's about judgment. You're judging yourself or you're judging them. You know, you're just a person who's different than they are, who maybe wishes you weren't, hopes you weren't, but the fact is you are. That's how you experience it. And as a result, you feel alone in this crowd. And that's sad. That's all. It's just...
So what do I do?
Nothing. It's just sad. You don't have to do anything.
Right.
Just sad. If you're sad, just feel sad. Nothing has to change. You'll be okay. They'll be okay. Nothing will change.
But the sad...
Pardon?
Dream, and especially around the holidays, it's fearful of sinking into a deep depression. And
yeah.
I've been there before, so, you know, I wonder if it's the loneliness that starts the spiral, and around the holidays it's exacerbated.
Well, clearly what... Go on, John.
Yes, we've actually looked at that question. We've done longitudinal research, and what it shows is that your level of loneliness can actually produce subsequent levels of depression, even controlling for levels of depression that you experience today. So your observation is an accurate one. But that doesn't mean that when family are there for the holidays that it will necessarily trigger that depression. It's really what you make of it. As suggested, you simply relax and feel, you know, allow yourself to feel whatever it is that you're going to feel. If you're going to feel sad, that's perfectly fine. But then, as soon as the holidays are over, reconnect with individuals who you like and just experience the holidays for what they are.
And what I'm hearing, Lauren, is that the depression doesn't come from feeling alone. What I'm hearing is that the depression comes from what your mind does with the experience of loneliness. So just stay with the feelings, and when your mind starts to dance around with it, just notice that your mind is running around in circles, but it's not you. It's just a mind, which, I don't know, if your mind is like mine, most of the time it just shouldn't be taken too seriously. Lauren, I wish you the best, and I wish you, more than anything, peace in the coming week, at least. We're going to have to take a short break, John. When we come back, we're going to talk with you. We're also going to talk with a dear friend of mine named Fanny, who relatively recently, lost her husband, who she's been married to for many, many years, and she's experiencing loneliness. That's what we're talking about today on Voices in the Family. We're talking about loneliness with John Cacioppo. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Chicago, and he's authored Loneliness, Human Nature, and the Need for Social Connection. If you're experiencing loneliness or have felt alone or the pain of being alone in a crowd, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
Do you remember these news stories on WHYY? Fred Thompson drops out of the race for the Republican presidential nomination. A Texas judge orders the removal of children from their polygamous families. John McCain loses count of his homes. Well, if they sound familiar, then you are listening in January, June, and August. And, of course, you're listening right now. The news coverage on WHYY is made possible by listener contributions. Please give today at whyy.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking with John Cacioppo about loneliness. He's a professor of psychology at University of Chicago, and he's written Loneliness, Human Nature, and the Need for Social Connection. You know, you talk about social connection, and when that's broken, it can be agony. And I talked before our break about a friend of mine named Fanny Litto. I think she's on the phone now, and I'd like to hear her story. Fanny? I guess we don't have her. We don't have her on the line quite yet. Okay. I had that experience. I guess we all did, John. I was in a terrible car accident some 30 years ago, and I was so disabled, that I really felt different from the rest of my species. I really didn't know if I was one of them ever. So I felt exquisitely alienated. It felt way beyond different than depression. I just felt exquisitely alone. And there was a way in which I felt liberated, too, that I didn't have to work so hard to try to be one of them. All those shoulds inside my head that we heard before the break, they were all gone because I couldn't do what I thought I was supposed to do. You there, John? Well, I guess we've lost John. Okay. Well, we'll try to get him back. Do we have Fanny on the line? Fanny?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Fanny. How are you?
Oh, hi, Dan. I'm okay. How are you?
Okay. So, listen, tell us a bit about your story. You were married for how many years?
60 years.
60 years.
Almost 61.
So, tell me about this guy you were married to.
Who I'm married with? My husband?
Yeah.
Well, it was a wonderful person. He was a happy person and he'd never wanted anything for himself. He just wanted everything for me and the children. And he smiled always, and he had such a wonderful personality.
Well, I know from our friendship that he developed Parkinson's.
Yes. And he had Parkinson's for over 30 years.
And ultimately, he was hospitalized.
He was what?
Hospitalized.
He was not hospitalized. He had to go into a nursing home because of the inability to function with me taking care of him at home. I was against my will, but everybody, the doctors, all insisted I could no longer do it because he was falling a lot.
So, Fanny, what I think is most touching for me in your story is when he went in that nursing home, you went to see him. You were with him 8-10 hours a day.
Yes, I did.
7 days a week for how many years?
That for 5.5 years.
Every day?
Every day.
All day.
I missed one day when the snow was so bad I couldn't get there. And there was one day when we had a bad snowstorm here, and I happened to see a plow go by, and I asked him to plow out the back of my car, which he did, and I was able to get over to the nursing home. It wasn't that far away. They all wanted to know how I got there.
And we can all assume that because you were married to this man 60 years that you were...
Pardon me?
We can assume that because you were married to this man 60 years, you were not a young woman when you were schlepping back and forth in this way.
Oh, right. Well, I'm 83 right now, and he's been gone 2.5 years.
What happened to you, Fanny, when he died?
What happened?
What happened to you?
What do you mean, since then?
Yeah.
Well, I'm in my apartment where I was before. Unfortunately, as we all know, a lot of our friends have passed away.
Are you lonely?
Yes. Yes, I think I've talked to you about that before. And I do a lot. I volunteer a lot, and I'm with people as much as I possibly can. And I'm lonely because he's not here.
So
let me
turn to John here. John, I want to tell you something. When Fanny, do we have you, by the way?
Yes.
Okay. When Fanny talks about her loneliness, I know she's doing everything right. I mean, most of her day is volunteering. She's involved. People love her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she loves She loves people. So when she talks about her loneliness, I feel helpless. And everybody who loves her, I'm sure, feels helpless. So help us, help her.
Right. First, I agree with you. Everything she's doing is exactly the right thing. And, you know, something else she said about her and her husband's relationship underscores... I'm sorry, did you want to say something, Dad?
No.
Okay. Something she said resonates with the point you and I were discussing earlier, and that is it's high-quality relationships that are important, not the number of relationships. It's one or two high-quality. And what high-quality means is that each person feels like they're getting more out of the relationship than they're putting in. Her description of her relationship with her husband was exactly of that kind. So it's a really sweet story. But that doesn't mean that you're guaranteed not to feel loneliness, as exactly she described. One thing that recent research has shown is that nostalgia can actually reduce feelings of loneliness. She's not going to get her husband back. But what she can do is to remember the times that they enjoyed together and to just reminisce when she's alone and feeling isolated. And that's been shown to actually lower levels of loneliness.
Fanny?
Yes?
When you reminisce about your husband, is that wistful? Is it a good feeling or is it a bad feeling?
Oh, it's always a good feeling because we had such wonderful times together. And we, as I said, for 60 years... And we never went anywhere without each other. And it was just, we were like, people would still say today, we were like one person. Everybody felt the same way. My children, my friends, everybody.
Yeah.
And I have wonderful children who have not abandoned me, have been with me constantly, and I'm with them. Dan, you know
so,
the things I've done.
So, Fanny, your life has been blessed in so many ways by having this wonderful marriage and these wonderful children. And John, I'll turn to you. Maybe this kind of loneliness is an almost inevitable byproduct of these wonderful gifts.
That's exactly right. And one thing that she will have, Fanny, you will have forever, and that is your memories. Those are treasures that you can enjoy for the rest of your life. And
uh-huh.
That's the one solace you can take, are those remarkable memories that most people never get to enjoy.
Fanny, I want to thank you so much for your call.
Thank you, Ben.
You really
for everything.
Are.
You've always been so wonderful.
Yeah, you're a blessing for everybody who knows you, and I look forward to our next cup of tea together.
Oh, I hope I'll see you soon.
Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So, despite what therapists and other humans want to say, this kind of loneliness that we hear in Fanny is a quality of grief and maybe can't be cured, or we shouldn't work hard on curing it. It's a fact of life.
Right. If she had withdrawn completely, that would be a signal to try to do something. But as you said, she's doing everything right. And her relationship with her husband was such an extraordinary one. That's just something that's best left for memories to be enjoyed during moments of privacy.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Charlie on the line. Charlie?
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, it's not really the classic loneliness, I guess. It, when he said feeling alone in a crowd is when I thought I'd call in. I've become an atheist over the past several years. And the rest of my extended family are religious to some extent. Some of them devout, Methodist, and some of them Catholic. My wife is still, I guess you could call her Catholic, but she's one of those people who goes to Mass so infrequently that I wonder to what extent she would identify as such. But it's recently come up that between the way we view the world and the way we want to raise our children, that I feel a threat of loneliness in that I could be isolated from the rest of the family very easily, because while being, say, gay might be accepted in my family, because they wouldn't see that as choice, they would see that as nature. And they're intelligent people, they're not backward and reactionary, like the stereotypes of people in a movie like Inherit the Wind would be,
right.
But they would see that as a choice to disavow the things that they've taught me. They would see that as a choice to distance myself from them.
Here's a question I want to bring up with you, Charlie, and with you, John. As I listen, I don't know if it's loneliness you're describing or anxiety about possibly feeling lonely. John, what are your thoughts about what you're hearing?
From what I've heard so far, I agree that it's the threat of losing family and friends because of a decision you've made.
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
Charlie?
At Christmas dinner, while I respect them and I love them, and I wouldn't say that they're unintelligent people, but when I discuss this with my wife, she says, you're just thinking you're smarter than everyone. You know something we don't. And that's not true. I just don't believe what they believe. And until I see evidence otherwise, why should I? You're the one making the claims of the supernatural. Let's hear your evidence. And she says, well, there you go, being a know-it-all. And it's that I feel like I'm sitting there being a hypocrite. In a room full of people who are devoutly praying and are sincere, I'm sitting there going through the motions so that I don't offend. And I feel like I should tell them how I think these days, because otherwise I feel like I'm disrespecting them by not being genuine.
Well, the reverse might be true. That telling them how you think might be disrespecting them. You know, it is... You're not going to win any arguments, and it seems unlikely that you're going to get people to agree with you. And you know what they say, politics and religion are not good table conversations if not everybody agrees. Now, it seems to me that the issue isn't loneliness. It's finding a way to grow comfortable with people who think differently than you do, and I think that's the task in life. That's the task in connection anyway. John, you agree? I mean, is how we connect.
Yes, there are three components of feelings of loneliness. One of the components is this social identity, being an American, being a professor, being a Catholic, or being an atheist. Those are social identities. And so if you see yourself as an atheist and others as antagonistic, I can see why that would make you feel distant from others. However, as Dan is suggesting, it's really that's an unnecessary distinction. Being connected is about transcending differences between people and finding commonalities. And what you and your family share in common is everyone has the right to believe in the existence or non-existence of God. Everyone has a right to live a principled life, and that gets operationalized in different ways, and one can respect other people's decision to believe and yours to not believe, and that's something that you really need not press, but instead find commonalities, and then that schism won't occur within the family.
Charlie, thanks so much for your call. Before we take our break, I just want to make one observation about one of your findings, speaking of religion, that I found particularly interesting. When you talked about religious people in your book, you found that the ones that lived longer were the ones who attended services most frequently, rather than the ones that feel their beliefs most deeply, which suggests that it's not faith that keeps them alive as much as people.
Right. People and the health behaviors that churches tend to promote.
People and the what?
The health behaviors. So people who go to church often are, on average, less likely to smoke, less likely to drink heavily. They engage in better health behaviors, and so that's also contributing to longevity.
Well, most religions also promote other healthy things, too. Caring for others, opening your door to the strangers, so on and so forth, which is
right.
Also contributes to psychological, if not spiritual, health.
Right.
We've got to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk about the internet, and I also want to talk about when we feel disconnected, not from others, but from ourselves, which might be the underpinnings of this whole discussion. My guest is John Cacioppo. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Chicago. He's written Loneliness, Human Nature, and the Need for Social Connection. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY FM, Philadelphia.
Happy I'm Rhonda Hamilton with you on New Year's Eve for a party with Hiromi's Sonic Bloom in Boston, New York Voices and the Dizzy Gillespie All-Star Big Band in Washington, the Mingus Big Band in New York, Evan Christopher's Clarinet Road in New Orleans, and Pink Martini in Los Angeles. Live and coast to coast on Toast of the Nation from NPR.
New Year's Eve at 8 o'clock on WHYY.
Visit exotic places.
You know, in another month, you don't want to be here, but right now, it's primo.
Meet fascinating people.
There's going to be fights and people drinking. It's what you do on Saturday night.
And enjoy fine conversation.
You look like a cowgirl. You know?
You're the first person that made me feel like I fit
No,
in
I meant
here.
That.
It's what great radio is all about.
Okay.
Join us for NPR's Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. I'm talking about loneliness with John Cacioppo. He's at University of Chicago, and he's written Loneliness, Human Nature, and the Need for Social Connection. I want to talk just briefly about the Internet, John. People, old people like me, my generation, baby boomers, tend to see Internet relationships as not real relationships, not fitting with, our need for human connection. What's the research showing that?
It's actually interesting. It shows that the Internet can either increase loneliness or decrease loneliness, depending on how it's used. If people are substituting Internet relationships for face-to-face contact, through face-to-face relationships, loneliness and depression go up. If, on the other hand, it's being used to connect when you're at a distance, to connect, to coordinate so that you can rendezvous and actually meet people, then it's associated with decreased loneliness and depression.
Well, there's another factor, too. I'm involved with the Christopher Reeve Foundation, and I'm on their webpage where I blog weekly. And, these are people who are... Most of them are disabled. Many have difficulty getting out, and that is their connection.
Right. That's the single exception, is those individuals who are otherwise not able to connect because they're isolated physically. Then the Internet has been a real boon. It allows people to connect and in very important ways, and for them it's a real benefit.
Any research on Internet psychotherapy?
Not much.
All right, just curious about that.
The one study that I do know was done in China. It was for depression, and it was effective. You were able to actually effectively deal with many, many millions of people through a means that you otherwise wouldn't be able to reach.
Hmm. Let's go to the lines. We've got Virginia on the line, who's also technology question. Hi, Virginia.
Hello.
Yes, hi.
Hi, I finally made it, I think.
What can we do for you?
Yeah, well, now, you talked about the Internet, which is great. I heard what you were saying there, but what about other entertainment devices like television? And certainly radio. I know that I have certain shows that I watch on TV. I mean, I have a schedule. And it's almost like I know that I might very possibly be lonely, but once I tune into my favorite show, I mean, I anticipate it. It takes the edge off of any loneliness, and I feel a sense of elation. Also, we're very vicarious by nature. At least I'm very vicarious. In other words, I can pick up a magazine and I can see something with Angelina Jolie, and it's like, yeah, I wonder what's going on in her life. And it's almost like I've made like these vicarious connections with other people that fill in some gaps for me. And
Virginia, I'm going to anticipate John's first question, and I could be wrong here, but tell us about the rest of your life. Do you have friends, social connections?
Well, actually, I'll tell you, what happens with me is I'm very, very friendly, very, very likable. And I have people approach me all the time, and I'm always talking to people. I drum up conversations in the grocery line, and next thing you know, it seems as though I've known this person for a long time, or if I'm in a bank, I'm not at a loss for words, I'm not shy. However, I have two people that I really, really like. Three, I've added an additional person now, who will visit me or call me and so forth and et cetera. But I'm very, very comfortable with myself and very, very much at peace. I'm very spiritual.
I think you've probably answered most of John's questions. John, any thoughts?
Yes, in fact, what she's talking about are in my field are called parasocial relationships. Relationships with pets, relationships with fictional characters, or even real characters. Oprah Winfrey is someone who many, many people relate to as a friend, even though they've never met her and probably will never meet her. That kind of association is very much like internet relationships. It's better than nothing. But it isn't the same thing as personal contact, in part because they don't hear your story. You actually can't confide in them and feel the warmth of having someone else understand you. So if you have such individuals, those kinds of parasocial relationships just amplify. In the absence of such relationships, though, the parasocial cues are not full replacements.
Hmm. Great. Virginia, thanks so much for your call. Let's see if we can get another call in. We've got Jenny on the line.
Hey there. I'm so happy to be contributing to the conversation. This is so exciting.
Great.
I'd just like to share a couple ideas. And loneliness is something I've really struggled with a lot. I grew up with a significant hearing loss, completely deaf in one ear. Excuse me. And I feel like I really struggled with loneliness for many years. Getting a hearing aid really helped. For any of your listeners who have difficulty with that, I'd really like to encourage them to explore the possibility of getting a hearing aid. It really has had a significant impact for me on my sense of loneliness, because I think just the little things that we hear from other people have to do with our sense of connection.
Are you still lonely?
Much less so. Much less so. And I feel like I've also just kind of worked through a lot of other issues about my loneliness. One idea I have about the holidays is that if we think of it in a sense as kind of a harvest time for the goodness of our relationships, a lot of it is contingent on what we've planted earlier on in the year in terms of the kindness that we've shown the people in our lives, I think. And I think sometimes we arrive at this heart at this time kind of wanting a bountiful harvest of goodwill with others, and if we don't look to the precedence of it, then I think we can feel disappointed or kind of not really understand what went wrong.
You know, Jenny, it sounds very much like what John was referring to about, you know, the quality of relationships is when both parties feel like they are giving more than they're getting. I think it's sound advice you've given it at lots of levels. And I want to thank you for your call. John, Jenny brings up a question that I want to hear your thoughts about as we wind down. In Greek mythology, the concept of a soulmate comes from Greek mythology. And, you know, the mythology is that our soul has been divided into two parts and sent to different parts of the universe. And our soulmate is really reconnecting with the missing part of our own soul. And I wonder if that's ultimately what's going on with the difference between being alone and being lonely, if we are connected with ourselves, with parts of ourselves, without judgment, with compassion, are we less likely to be lonely?
Hello?
Yes.
Sorry, Dan. I had a phone. Are you there?
Yes. Well, we've got a bad connection.
Yes, I'm sorry. It's just bad.
Are you there?
Yes.
I was just wondering if ultimately loneliness was a byproduct of having a sense of being disconnected from ourselves.
Yes, in fact, I mentioned components of loneliness. One of the more central components is this feeling of others affirming who you are to yourself. That's actually the most important component. It's exactly as you described.
Yeah. Do you have something going on in the background there?
No, I had to switch phones. I had a phone problem.
Oh, I'm sorry. So you were saying about connection with ourselves.
Right. Others affirm who you want to be the best that you can be, when there's no one around to affirm that aspect of you, A, you're less likely to be the best person in your own mind, and B, you feel disconnected, isolated. That's where the real painful experience of isolation comes from.
Yeah. Well,
the best predictor of that is marital status. Marital partners tend to affirm, in part, affirm who you would like to be and make you a better person in your own mind.
I'm going to have to thank you, because we've got such a bad connection. But I do want to thank you, John, for your work. I think it's fascinating, and boy, you're in a great place to do the research you're doing. University of Chicago's got a great reputation for this kind of work. Let me just reintroduce you at the end. John Cacioppo is a professor of psychology at the University of Chicago. He's written Loneliness, Human Nature, and the Need for Social Connection. I talked about Greek mythology and how the Greek gods have fought for dominion over man's soul and have agreed to divide man's soul in half, and that is our plight, that is our plague, is to reconnect with different parts of ourselves. My experience with being alone, and those I work with in the office, their experience of being alone, seems to diminish when we stop judging ourselves, when we can ultimately find compassion for the person we are instead of pushing ourselves to be the people we could be or should be or may have been. And, you know, like so many other things, a little bit of compassion really makes fundamental changes in our lives and in the lives of those we love. I loved what John had to say about the quality of relationship is being in a relationship where both partners feel like they are giving more than they're getting. If you're in a relationship that's a zero-sum game, you've got a painful way of looking at it. Well, that's all the time we have on today's show. Next week, we'll be talking about music and the brain. You can reach us at voices@whyy.org, and I'm at dangottlieb.com. The engineer for today's show has been Kevin Griffin. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of radio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Gita Simons and Elisa Walters. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Have a good week and have a good, healthy, happy new year, my friends. Thank you.